Okay, I'd like to call the meeting to order. And Representative Meyer, would you be able to move the minutes?
Madam Chair, yes, I have reviewed the minutes and I move them.
Okay. All those in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes are approved.
And thank you. Today we have Representative Mullery presenting a bill on children's mental health. And so would you introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Mullery. And I'll move House File 357 and have it sent to Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Should I just go ahead?
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, basically this is a bill with an amount to be set in Health and Human Services Finance to fund special projects for treatment and support to adolescents and young adults who are experiencing either psychotic symptoms or their first psychotic episode, and then a second part of it is for training mental health and healthcare professionals on screening and identification of early psychosis. And we have several testifiers today, Madam Chair, and the first will be Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are very supportive of this legislation. There was a task force that began meeting last fall on first psychotic episode as part of the Department of Human Services Reform 2020. And one of the things that we know is that when a young person experiences their first psychotic episode, that we can actually support them and have them, the trajectory of their life, go in a positive way, or we can do nothing or allow them to be hospitalized multiple times, you know, end up homeless, you know, in our criminal justice system. And, of course, you know, those are not good outcomes. We do not, frankly, in our mental health system, provide intensive supports at this stage. We let people fail multiple times before we provide a little bit of something. Schizophrenia is probably one of the most difficult diagnoses to live with. And, you know, if you think about it, you're, you know, maybe in your 20s, you're at college for the first time, you're hearing voices, delusional thoughts, having trouble studying in school. You might be self-medicating, taking alcohol or drugs in order to kind of work your way through it. You don't know what's going on. And it's a very scary thing. What we wanted to do was to establish some pilot projects in the state of Minnesota. There is some history on doing this around the country. They're called RAISE projects, to really intervene early and effectively with these young people. And when we looked at what kinds of things could you do, one of them is to make sure that, one, they have medication management, because we know medications are really an important piece of this. We need to find the right medication, the side effects that a person can tolerate so that they'll continue taking it. Psychoeducation, actually, for the individual and the family is very helpful so that they understand the illness, the family knows what's going on and knows how to help. Care coordination, they also may need some substance use treatment. There might be some other comorbid conditions that need to be coordinated. Either employment or higher education. No one gets better sitting in their apartment by themselves and watching daytime TV and drinking coffee. All of us, especially when you're young, you need to have a goal in life. You need to have something to do and to get out of your home. And so helping them get a job, helping them continue and finish their education, their higher education, is important. Cognitive behavioral intervention, so they know what to do. There's actually even some computer training programs that can help with their cognition. Peer support groups. What we don't want them to be is loners. We want them to be connected to another individual. And when you're also with another young adult who also is experiencing these same symptoms, that really helps to know that you're not the only one. Families need some support as well. Social skills training. They may not have very good skills in interacting with others once this illness hits them. We want to make sure that there's crisis planning as a part of it, stress management, and supportive housing if they can no longer live with their families. The second part of the bill is to really make sure that both mental health professionals and healthcare professionals understand first psychosis. People often wait sometimes a year or more before they're seeking help with this particular illness, and that's frankly way too long. We need to be intervening early, and we need to make sure that our healthcare professionals understand what's going on. So just in summary, and I'm happy to stay around to answer any questions as always, but I think this is a really good first step in intervening with the appropriate intensity with one of the most serious mental illnesses that exists.
Thank you. Representative Mullery, who else did you have?
Michelle Buckley from the program at the university that Dr. Schultz runs, and he couldn't be here today, but she works with him, and she also testified in the Senate today for him.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Michelle Buckley. I'm a licensed associate marriage and family therapist at the University of Minnesota Psychiatry Clinic. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. First episode psychosis is a particularly traumatic time for young people because of they're dealing with some really significant and distressing symptoms. Patients at this time are also very distressed to kind of see their cohort of friends continuing on with their goals as patients are struggling with symptom management and taking time off of work or school to recover. We liken the recovery process for a first episode patient as being similar to like a traumatic brain injury, which can be a 1 to 2 year process to regain cognitive capabilities that had been in decline. Along with the patients, the families of patients with first episode psychosis are significantly impacted, and their distress comes from seeing their child experience these symptoms, suddenly returning to their childhood home if they had left, and at times needing very high levels of care. Distress in families can have a negative impact on the patient's recovery if it results in high levels of expressed emotion, which consists of criticism, hostile interactions, family isolation, and unhelpful communication styles or interaction patterns. The optimal set of services we believe are necessary for treatment include weekly outpatient medication follow-up, weekly combinations of individual cognitive behavioral therapy and family therapy, and weekly family psychoeducation groups with the incorporation of more family therapy and psychoeducation on inpatient units. Without special grants in place, treatment often consists of follow-ups on medication every few months after hospital discharge and may not involve family education or therapy that can identify and address specific cases of high expressed emotion in families. Without these weekly appointments, treatment and medication adherence significantly decline among this population, which is often due to experiences of negative side effects with antipsychotic meds, which cannot be adequately managed only every few months, and a lack of insight into being sick, which therapy can immediately begin to address, and establish rapport with your therapist helps with patients staying in programs even when relapse occurs. Families without psychoeducation or family therapy to address specifically family issues, often occurring long before the episode happens, have trouble identifying what the psychotic symptoms are, experience caregiver burnout, and have trouble identifying their support systems in their community. Again, this results in lower treatment adherence, high expressed emotion, and high chance to relapse among patients. Families need some significant amounts of support during this time and learning about the cognitive declines that their child has now experienced. Families cannot do this alone and derive significant benefit from meeting others near them that have been struggling with the same issues and provide support. So my personal experience in providing cognitive behavioral therapy, family therapy, and psychoeducation for these patients at the U of M has shown me the significant need for the recommended optimal set of services I've outlined. I've directly seen the benefit of patients being able to establish a healthy rapport with all the providers and the positive difference that's made in long-term outcomes when they have a collaborative team of providers looking out the best interest of not just the patient but also the family. I've been informed by both patients and families how much they appreciate knowing there's a team of us that want to help and the extensive training and knowledge in this field. So I fully support all efforts placed into more training for mental health providers in this area and increased funding for more availability of all of these services. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I believe, is Louise Sundin.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee and state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and author and Chair Mullery and committee members. My name is Louise Sundin, and I'm here representing the 9,200 teachers, ESPs, and retirees in the Minneapolis schools. And I want to start by thanking the chair and this committee for focusing on both early education and mental health issues. It's such important. They're such important issues, and we really appreciate the opportunity to hear all of the powerful testimony we've heard in the last few weeks. It's in that vein that we're here to tell you about a program called The Collaborative, a program to meet some of the school-based mental health needs of adolescents and young adults, and we hope get into the early identification, early observation, early intervention. With me is Dr. Jim Nelson. He is co-president of Change Inc. and a licensed family therapist. Change Inc. is an organization that advocates for organizational change and supports folks through change processes, which he's done many times over the years. It's a painful process, as you all know. Jim teaches graduate students in family therapy, and he and I partnered on several projects, beginning way back when he taught some courses in Union University. One was called the R Factor, or the Relationship Factor, which is helping teachers build relationships with difficult students and children, and a sense of place, which helped identify and relate with teachers with families of those children. When I was a full-time union goon, I heard from teachers locally and nationally that there are kids, so many children with mental health who need mental health support, and adolescents and high school students. And it all gelled in my mind the day I got a call saying that there was a middle grades girl who was on the roof of one of our middle schools hearing voices and telling her to jump. The student had been hospitalized, obviously, with serious mental issues, but her parents' insurance ran out, and so the hospital said, we're done, and you have to go back to school. Obviously, she wasn't ready to go back to school. When we all agreed then that we needed to listen to those teachers who all said with one voice, something has to be done to help those children and their families. They were right. So we created the Edison Collaborative at Edison High School in Minneapolis. The goal was to get multiple health, mental health professionals in training to observe, identify, help students early, on site, on time, on target, in a cost-effective model. Those multiple bodies include interns, externs, residents, psychiatrists, and psychologists from graduate training institutions in the metro area. Like student teachers, they're finishing their professional training with extended practicums. They have no office hours and no offices. Their instructions are to hang with the kids where the kids hang. And so they're in some odd places now and then, but places like lunchrooms and others out on the sidewalk. But and that early intervention and that early observation from multiple observers is what we feel has been so important, those boots on the ground who are among the students. But I'm jumping ahead, so Jim will explain the program and the partners and the potential and the results for replication and for spreading throughout the state. And we're hoping that this bill will help support replication and spreading. Jim?
Thank you. And Mr. Nelson, proceed, and we're asking you to move through quickly if you can. Thank you.
My name is Dr. James Nelson, and I'm president of Change Inc. I'm also, our organization's in a collaborative with Guadalupe Alternative Programs in St. Paul. We are currently involved in 8 schools, 4 high schools, 4 K-8 schools, 1 in St. Paul and the rest in Minneapolis, inner city schools. We're relationally embedded in the schools. Edison is our flagship school. We, as Louise mentioned, we provide prevention, early intervention, informal diagnosis and treatment. We utilize currently 18 graduate interns and 9 postgraduate externs, providing training with for them before they come in and supervision while they're in the program by mental health professionals. We have critical partners on this where we couldn't get the job done if we didn't have the partnerships for the funding and the support in the schools. Obviously, both Guadalupe Alternative Programs and Change Inc. are community-based, mission-driven organizations. It's really critical from our vantage point that community agencies are involved, because oftentimes they're aware of things that take place in the community that's going to come up in the school. And that allows us to have kind of an early warning thing about conflict and trauma in the community that can result in early psychotic symptom bearing young people coming up in schools. Secondly, obviously, the school and their district, the funding stream right now is that the district or the school put up $30,000, and then we are to bill for the diagnosis and treatment for the remainder of the money. That ends up taking probably 3 years using graduate students to get up to capacity. So we've got quite a few of our activities in terms of early intervention and prevention and groups that we run, whether they're crisis groups. Just for example, one school year at Edison, we begin the year with the murder, we ended the year with the murder. And there were probably 30, 40 kids in that school that were impacted by that, and it was critical to address the needs of those young people in the school without having it ripple through the whole school. And we were able to help the staff go about their business while we dealt with those young people with community folks. Our third critical partner is the county. We couldn't get stuff done without the help of Jamie Halpern and Mark Sander and others, and also the Hennepin County Children's Mental Health Collaborative. I understand St. Paul has a similar collaborative. Those are excellent gathering places for mental health resources in both counties, and then the graduate schools. The fact that we're doing training with 18 interns and 9 externs gives us an opportunity to develop professionals that will then be able to turn around and work in schools, which is not an easy environment to be in, and you've got to develop particular partnerships with those teachers and administrative staff as well as the community. We are in the school. We are also do family therapy in home. We reach out in the community to do those in-home services, and we're also doing outreach in the community. So that takes care of the stuff that we're doing. One of our biggest problems is with the funding stream just being limited to a formal diagnosis and treatment. We run the risk of collapsing into a diagnosis for dollars sort of thing, where if you get any kind of ambiguity, you can't provide services without any kind of funding attached to it. So it really relies on the beneficence of those community organizations to provide those services. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity, and also members of the committee, Representative Mulery. Where'd he go to? Thank Representative Mulery as well.
And Madam Chair, you might have figured out that he didn't grow up in Lake Wobegon, but we partner pretty well with him anyway. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Abraham. Sundin. Yes, and do you have another one, Dr. Tim Burkett?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Tim Burkett, CEO of People Incorporated. I want to applaud the committee for focusing this afternoon on mental health services to children. As the largest community-based provider of services to folks with mental illness in the state, we have an entire continuum of services to adults and to children. But we believe that it's our children's service that have the most vital part in the community, and yet children's services just don't receive the funding that adult services receive. So I'm really pleased to hear you focusing on this. These services are vitally important, the ones that are currently provided and the ones that need to be provided. We know that early intervention is the key to successfully dealing with a mental illness diagnosis. And even before you get a mental illness diagnosis, it turns people's lives around. Early identification of psychotic symptoms prevents deterioration and development of careers as disabled individuals. We served 6,000 adults this last year. Unfortunately, most of them have entered into careers as disabled individuals. We served 1,000 kids. We're trying to help them turn their lives around, get the community support they need so they don't need to have careers like that, because it's an alienating career and it's an expensive career, and we all know that. There are a smattering of school districts around the state that have mental health professionals in schools, and we have mental health professionals in many different schools, but even with us and several other providers, there are many school districts that have no mental health professional support at all. There are a smattering of school districts in this state that have alternatives to school for kids who've already developed psychotic symptoms. We have half-day programs in several school districts around the seven-county area where they go just to school for a half-day and then a half-day with our mental health professionals working on how to deal with their stress, working how to deal with their suicidal tendencies, with their delusions, with their hallucinations, so they can remain in society. We have a smattering of school districts where we have preschool programs, and those preschool programs, we get kids who are identified by their doctors, kids who are identified by their child caregivers, by their parents, by their social workers, and they come and they spend 4 hours a day with us and other providers, again, just in smattering communities around the state.
Mr. Burkett, could you wrap it up quickly?
Yep. And we need more of that stuff. So it's this: the psychotic episode doesn't have to need to be a radically life-altering event. With the support of the community. So thank you so much for considering this bill.
And members, are there questions? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate. Want to thank the author of the bill for bringing to our attention the issues of mental health, especially in youth. I think obviously it's something we need to be. It's one of the critical things we need to look out for as state representatives, as public officials. But my question, I guess, is related to the bill itself, and I'm not sure how to phrase it other than, what are we funding exactly? What are the results we'll get, and how much money are we funding? And maybe the funding part, I guess the question for the chair is the funding part of this committee, or does that go to HHS Finance?
It will go to the next committee. It will go to Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay.
And Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, the last two presentations, I think, mistook what the bill was about. It's not about school-based clinics at all, and Ms. Abderholden explained it to a couple of your members beforehand, but I think it would be good to briefly explain it so that you understand what the bill is really for. And it does get, we don't have funding in this committee, so it will be, the funding will be in the next committee.
And Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, our thought was that, you know, and we could put a sentence in here if that would help, they would bill, these projects would bill for third parties. So if the person is on private insurance or Medicaid, and they bring in as many dollars as they can, kind of like the schooling grants, you know, they have to bill to bring in those dollars. But there's some things that insurance doesn't pay for, and they don't necessarily pay for the intensity of this treatment. They don't pay for supported employment. They don't pay for supported education, and we want to make sure, again, that young person gets that so they don't become disabled by their condition. What we have found, you know, over the last, well, I've been with NAMI 11 years, is that Often when we start something as a grant project in the mental health world, and we and in Minnesota at least, we really engage the private health plans. Once they see that something is effective, then they start paying for it. For example, crisis teams were initially funded by mainly grants. Most of the health plans in Minnesota now will reimburse for that because they've seen the importance of, and actually how it reduced costs because we have fewer hospitalizations and things like that through the crisis teams. I can tell you that all of the grants that have gone out of the Children's Mental Health Division have many strings attached. So we would, you know, we've been able to provide you data about crisis teams and about the schooling to mental health. The same would be true here. So we'd make sure that we have, you know, the number of young people that are served. We can track how much private insurance has brought in to help cover the costs. We can be measuring people's outcomes in terms of what are their symptoms going down, how many hours a week are they working, have they graduated from school. So we'll really make sure that, as we do with the Children's Mental Health Grants, that all of that is encompassed in the grants.
Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thanks for that explanation. And that really gets to the thoughts I have regarding the small amount of language in the bill and how it relates to many tentacles of funding to various mm-hmm. sources. And again, back to the issue of outcome, because that's what we want. We want mm-hmm. healthier kids. And so couldn't some language be introduced into the bill that would require information about how effective that funding was to make our kids more healthy?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, I would have no problem including that language. You know, as I have testified numerous times this week, you know, we worked fast and furious to put these bills together, and we know that they're not perfect. We're ready to work with anyone to add changes to it. Again, I think they should be billing third party for wherever they can, and we absolutely should be collecting data and outcomes, and I'd be happy to, you know, between now and finance, work with you, or there's some language in another bill coming through this committee, work on some language with you to put that in there.
Okay. And then one follow-up question. If
I yes, could. Representative Barrett.
Then as it relates to the issue of, it talks about intensive treatment and supports. I'm assuming the supports are for the diagnosis of psychosis. And I wanted to look here. I'm sure you probably know Ms. Abderholden, but this is specific to psychosis as opposed to depression, bipolar, borderline, addiction. So I'm wondering how, and it gets back into the question of making sure that our kids are healthy and obviously preventing suicide. Just be blunt. Obviously, there are too many kids committing suicide, and we want to do what we can to eliminate that. But so how does psychosis relate to the other diseases that are maybe, I don't know, I don't want to compare one to the other, but equal or more people have depression, more kids do. I guess I don't know how psychosis compares to other diseases and why we're specifically targeting one particular diagnosis when there are many others.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett. So we have a lot of different bills to try to get at many different illnesses. So the schooling to mental health, you know, certainly because it's providing early identification and intervention, we think will actually help in terms of reducing the suicide rate amongst our youth because we're providing the services right there. You know, psychosis and, you know, schizophrenia affects about 1% of the population. They actually have very high risk of suicide as well. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of trying to figure out what I would compare it to. It's really one of the most more serious mental illnesses. It's people have the most difficult time with their medication, staying on it, finding a medication that they'll stay on. I would say they often cost us the most money in terms of frequent hospitalizations. That's why assertive community treatment teams were developed. So it's a very high-risk group for becoming really most seriously disabled by their illness. And when we talk to families in the community with schizophrenia too, they may not even know they're ill, so then they won't, you know, because of the impact on the brain, so then they're even less likely to have treatment. If you talk to homeless providers, shelters, they often see people with schizophrenia on the streets, and, you know, it's not free to have someone be homeless. Mm-hmm. So because of the high impact, we really wanted to say, you know, our mental health system isn't doing well with this small percentage of people in particular. So can we do something to really prevent the high-cost services that they may end up using the rest of their lives if we intervene early and intensively right when the first psychotic episode happens.
Thank you.
And I'm just wondering, if you're having five pilot projects, I should think there'd be accountability built into that to see how they work. Is that true, Ms. Adderholen?
Madam Chair, we don't actually have a number. We just said pilot projects. Depending on the money, maybe there'd be one, maybe there'd be two. We'd certainly like to have more than just the University of Minnesota, and then there's a tiny project funded by the federal government through North Point and Human Development Center, where they're actually comparing people who don't get the same amount of treatment. So there's some tiny bit of research happening around the country on this because other people are seeing the same thing. But we know that, you know, I think we can do better in Minnesota in moving forward on this issue. So again, it'll be up to how much funding is appropriated.
Okay, and I was just wondering, if it's a pilot, you usually want to know what the results were as to whether you expand it. So there must be something built in to look at it afterwards.
And Madam Chair, because of our experience with the Children's Mental Health Division, where with all the grants that we developed in 2007, they all, with the Mental Health Initiative, the Bipartisan Mental Health Initiative, we didn't even think to add that to the language because we're so used to it happening within the Children's Mental Health Division. I know Glennis Edwell is here, who heads the Children's Mental Health Division, and I don't know if she would have anything to say, but she always attaches many strings to the grants that go out of the door.
All right. Thank you. Representative Myra.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm looking at line 1.7, talking about funds special projects, and I was wondering exactly who will be coordinating or managing those special projects, and if you can elaborate on that, please.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Representative Myra, I think the author, head of NAMI would have the best analysis of that, and the department can also probably get involved.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think this would have to be, in a sense, co-led by the Children's Mental Health Division and the Adult Mental Health Division, because you're not sure exactly what age that will, happen. It could be 16, it could be 18. Typically, it's more 18 to 22, kind of right around that age group. For the training, it would really, my guess is that the department would work with, the medical school, some of the guilds, whether it's the social work, psychiatrists, so that training is incorporated. Again, this first psychotic episode group at the department, this was one of their recommendations because we actually had people from the family practice there saying, we don't know what to do when a young person comes into my office with these symptoms. So it's just some kind of overall training that could be provided through the various guilds.
Madam Chair.
Representative Myra.
Representative Mullery and Ms. Adderholen, earlier you said that you'd be willing or open to adding a sentence to clarify that. Could we have a oral amendment to just tighten up that language and make it a little more clear?
Do you want to do that now, or do you want to do that before you go to the next committee? Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, if there's a sentence that we could put it on now, I don't know if she's currently working on something.
Okay, well, while we do that, should we move on to the next?
Certainly, and I had one more question.
Go ahead.
And I was wondering about, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I was wondering about, are parental rights protected under this bill? How is that all coordinated?
Madam Chair, Representative, they would not be impacted by this at all. The existing laws governing, HIPAA and parental consent and all of that would be as they are now.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Howe?
No.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery?
I believe she has the sentence.
I have an idea for a sentence.
Ms. Abderholen?
We could add on line 1.13, the department will track data and outcomes of the projects. Something simple. Is there a lawyer in the room?
We'll give a minute for our research person to look it over. Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think that's a good start. I think also if we could include in that that the department will report back to the legislature by a particular date on the findings of the money used and the results gained.
Okay. We'll let our research person put that together. Okay.
Madam Chair, I have no objection to that.
So okay, I would. So it'll be a friendly amendment. You'll incorporate it. All right. Is there anybody in the audience that wanted to speak to this bill? Okay. Any other questions from the members here? And we did get one letter from somebody who could not be here, Dr. Karen Ephraim, who sent a letter via email, and that will be distributed to the members also.
Thank you.
Just comment that there's an awful lot possible in this session for our mental health for young people, and it's exciting to see.
So thank you, Madam Chair. We're very excited as well.
Madam Chair, we'll be seeing a bunch of bills next week that just came from Health and Human Services.
All right, thank you.
And also with respect to the testimony from the other two groups that were here about school-based, I'm very supportive, and I'm working also with Representative Mariani on how those bills should go between the committees, because there's kind of a cross of jurisdiction.
Right, and I'm carrying one myself. So we'll get some things done this session. Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, members, I have as a preliminary draft for an oral amendment, page 1, line 13, after the period, insert, the commissioner shall track project data and by November 1st, 2015, submit a report concerning outcomes to the legislative committees having jurisdiction over human services and early childhood.
Oh. Do you want it read again, one more time?
Just the year.
Pardon?
November of what year? We weren't sure.
2015 is what I have here. It would be following the end of that fiscal year.
Okay. Representative Mullery, is that okay to incorporate that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, we'll incorporate that. So, Representative Mullery renews his motion to pass as amended and refer to the House File 357 to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you so much.
When Ms. Abderholden asked if there were any attorneys, I said, wait till the next bill. Representative Moline, do you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 392 be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Representative Moline, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we do have a number of people that want to be heard on this bill, so I'll try to go as quickly as possible. Current law provides that juvenile hearings are automatically open to the public if the child is 16 or 17 years old and the allegation is a felony. My bill proves that this standard continues to apply for adult certification hearings. Extended juvenile jurisdiction hearings for 16 and 17-year-olds would be opened on the prosecutor's request, and other extended juvenile jurisdiction and delinquency hearings, the court would need to determine that due to the violent or serious nature of the alleged offense, the benefit to the public safety of holding an open hearing outweighs the potential consequences for the child due to the resulting public records. My bill also would keep related juvenile delinquency and EJJ records closed to the public unless the new proposed standards for a public hearing are met. And just a little bit of history for members on, you know, where this is coming from. This, the bill that opened all hearings for 16 and 17-year-olds who were accused of a felony was passed in 1986. And the resulting records became public, even if the charges were later dismissed or reduced against the juvenile. And since 1986, more crimes have been made felonies. Criminal records have been made publicly available through centralized electronic sources. And the number of background checks have skyrocketed, and that includes background checks for employment, for to get into college. And many parents are shocked to find out that their son or daughter who, you know, had allegation of a felony against them as a 16 or 17-year-old is unable to pursue employment opportunities or even higher education opportunities because of their public record. In 2010 alone, there were 2,646 felony-level delinquency petitions filed against 16 and 17-year-olds. And again, those records are public, even if the allegations against the juvenile are dismissed. My bill still has a number of safeguards in it. It does allow the court to open the hearings if the judge determines that the sort of public right to know the information outweighs the juvenile's interest in having those records kept private. And all victims will still have access to the hearings. And so there are a number of safeguards still in there, but I think that this is just, you know, sort of updating it with the times and the technology we have and how available public records have become. And, you know, at this point, with a number of testifiers being here, I think I'll ask. Oh, and yeah, just one last comment. I think there are going to be a couple of, you know, stakeholders here opposing the bill, but just so members know, this is a bill with really broad bipartisan support. I think it's an issue that, you know, we've been able to come forward with on both sides of the aisle. So just so members are aware that this bill does have broad bipartisan support. So, and I have with me here Mark Hossie from the Council on Crime and Justice.
Thank you, Representative Moline. I just wanted to let everybody know we're trying to figure out times, and so the best is we got to give each side half, and we know about three that are against, so we'll have to say about 15 minutes roughly for each side, and because there'll probably be quite a few questions, I'm guessing. There's already starting to be some. So go ahead, Mr. Hossie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing about this important issue. I am, as Representative Moline said, with the Council on Crime and Justice. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of 50 different community organizations that support this work. I'll keep my comments very brief because there's people coming that can speak much better to this issue. I did want to mention the racial disparities issue on this because I don't know that anybody will speak about this later. This is a change, and this is the current law affects youth throughout Minnesota. The majority of them are white youth, but when you look at the disparate impact upon communities, youth of color, this would not necessarily change that, but it would help to mitigate some of the collateral consequences, and also it would help to hopefully stop some of the other gaps in education and housing and employment that we see. and Minnesota has some of the highest. Just a quick statistic, according to the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee's 2012 report, a child of color is 3 times more likely to be arrested than a white youth in Minnesota, and an African-American child is 6 times more likely to be arrested. So when they're arrested, if it's a felony charge under current law, if it's a public record, they're going to continue to have more difficulties as they move forward in life and potentially contribute to the other racial gaps we see. Representative Moline covered the mechanics of the bill, so I won't do that. I just want to mention who's supporting this bill, and then many of them are here to testify. This is actually part of the legislative agenda of the Minnesota Corrections Association, the Council on Crime and Justice, the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, and the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. It's also supported by the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, the Minnesota Association of Community Probation Officers, and the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association. With that, I think we'll have our other testifiers come up.
Thank you. In fact, could you get them ready to go? Just state your name and go ahead.
Sure, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Will Lehman, and I'm here representing Youth Intervention Services from the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities. My organization serves youth involved in the juvenile justice system by providing community-based services in a variety of capacities to produce an array of youth development outcomes. I'm here to stress the profound negative effects of data sharing when it comes to the records of juvenile offenders, specifically the records made public for youth ages 16 and 17 with felony-level charges. A large percentage of the juvenile offenders we serve at the YMCA fit into this demographic. Of that group, a significant amount turn their lives around and veer onto successful paths away from their formerly criminal behaviors. Yet, while we work successfully with youth to produce a variety of outcomes, including educational success and pro-social activities in the community, we continually see the formidable barriers to our third outcome, employment success. Young people we serve who have public records, regardless of their ability to stray from their criminal paths and become contributing citizens, are time and time again unable to obtain employment. The vast majority of employers share data on juvenile records and have stringent HR policies preventing hiring managers from making exceptions for these youth, despite our aggressive efforts to form partnerships with them. Due to our struggles with helping youth with public records to overcome this nearly impenetrable barrier to employment, we developed an employment program within our department that provides crucial job skills training to the youth we serve, as well as a paid internship at a YMCA branch in the department of their choice. This program has been put into place to fill an incredible need for our clientele whose records are public to employers. However, this kind of program should not have to exist to provide meaningful work experience for a youth population that has proven they deserve access to the same opportunities other youth and young adults are afforded. These public records also follow these youth into adulthood when they are expected to become independent citizens and taxpayers. Yet, with the data sharing on their records across virtually all employers and agencies, they are being set up for unemployment and are routinely forced into such challenging situations beyond their control. In order to provide the opportunity for employment success for this important sub-demographic of youth, we at Youth Intervention Services at the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities urge you today to reconsider making records public for juveniles with felony-level charges at ages 16 and 17. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moline. Do you have some, can you have them ready to go? So, because there's only about 8 minutes left, around that. Nine.
Hello, my name is Travis Granzi, and I am here today representing the Minnesota Corrections Association. I'm the chair of the Juvenile Justice Committee. We're here today to voice our support for the bill that's being proposed. We feel strongly that there were some purposeful differences that were created between the criminal world and the delinquency world, and that this the way the law stands right now, it kind of runs contrary to that. I'm a juvenile probation officer, and I've worked with kids in the delinquency system for about 18 years. And during the course of that time, it's become very apparent that despite a lot of the work that we do as probation officers in an effort to help these kids, rehabilitate these kids, help them overcome some of the hurdles and struggles that they've had in their lives, that oftentimes they're faced with many challenges moving forward tied specifically to their criminal history, which has become public information. So despite our best efforts and the work that we do in an effort to make sure that they have an opportunity to turn their lives around, which is the purpose of delinquency court, sometimes they face these hurdles in regards to their jobs, housing, college. So it really runs contrary to the differences that were created in the law, which were created for very good reasons. With that, Andrea Emery is a member of our committee as well.
Hi, again, my name is Andrea Emery. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Corrections Association. I've been a juvenile probation officer for 14 years. And Travis did a great job of presenting already. I would just like to add to that I was hoping to come up here and talk to you guys about some relevant case examples, and I wasn't really able to come up with, you know, this one particular case or the next one particular case because there are so many. On a weekly basis, we have either present youth or past youth that are coming back to us, sometimes in tears, sometimes with their parents, completely not understanding that all of these records were public, simply because they were charged with a felony level offense at the time. Now, they may come in, they may enter a plea to a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor, but it doesn't matter. Anybody can sit at home on their home computer and do a backgrounds check on them, and they're going to see what that original offense was. And most potential employers are not going to go back to look through, well, what did they plead to? What all happened in court? Everything that happens in court becomes part of that public record. And, you know, they may get hired, they may work through all the juvenile system, complete probation successfully, and then they head into Subway, apply for a job. They pass the interview process, they do very well, get hired, start a day or two of employment, and then pretty soon they're let go because that records check came back. And it just seems like it's us kind of preventing them. And the same thing kind of goes with public housing. When they go to apply for housing, because it's part of public records, most public housing, at least in our community, will not take anybody who has been charged with a felony level offense. And what happens to these kids is when they have no place to live and they have no income, they go back to that same lifestyle that they once lived. And so it just seems like the current setup is setting them up to fail, even though we know by research that most juveniles do not continue to commit crimes as adults. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna McLafferty. I'm the Criminal Justice Director at the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota, or NAMI. Youth with mental illnesses are disproportionately represented in the juvenile justice system. So while there are 1 in 5 youth in the community who live with a mental illness, in the juvenile justice system it's 65% to 75%. This committee and others have been hearing several bills this week about investing in our youth through a stronger children's mental health system, and this bill fits into that work. It ensures that kids who get in trouble before they get help don't have to pay for their mistakes and for the gaps in today's children's mental health system well into their adult lives. I often hear the argument that expungement may be available to some people who have public juvenile records. In my experience, however, that's not enough. NAMI responds to many calls from families with children in the juvenile justice system, many of whom are facing public felony records. Even for kids who have abundant family support, by the time expungement becomes a possibility, the public felony record has already become a source of precariousness that makes it much harder for the kid to go on and lead a healthy adult life. These kids can't find housing, they can't get a start on their careers, they've lost many financial aid and higher education opportunities, and they're missing chances to forge the positive peer relationships that most of us built when we were that age and that have carried on with us and been social, important sources of social connection for us for the rest of our lives. Without these things, mental health recovery is so much harder to achieve and maintain. For 16 and 17-year-olds facing felonies, judges should have the discretion to determine what's in the public's best interest versus in the child's. The decision as to whether a hearing should be public should not be predetermined by the charges themselves in a one-size-fits-all way. Instead, it should be based on factors like whether the child in question lives with an untreated or undertreated mental illness and whether he or she will engage in treatment that can address those underlying issues. Prosecutors and law enforcement are not typically in a position to determine those things. It's the defense attorneys who are in the best position to inform the court about those issues. Just to conclude, for kids in the juvenile justice system, we know that mental health treatment is an effective way to reduce recidivism. The National Coalition for Juvenile Justice has examined available research and found that the most successful mental health programs, those that treat kids in the community along with treating their families, can reduce recidivism by 80%. But if those kids don't have the ability to move on after that treatment and after they've served their time in the system, then that investment in treatment just isn't worth as much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier who's going to be very brief,
Judge,
and then we can go to those
Judge
who are
Bastion?
Opposition.
It could be. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Judge. And since there's so much fanaticism about lawyers getting paid off, I have to disclose that Judge Bastion bought all of us from Minnesota a derby pie in Louisville at a juvenile justice conference.
That was probably about 6 years ago, so hopefully I've lost.
I was joking. Knowledge. That's not.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Bastion. I'm a district court judge in Ramsey County. I've been on the bench for about 15 years, and I have served 5 years in juvenile. I'm here to support the bill. I believe the case-by-case basis to have a judge look at the file would provide that dispassionate view that would make it much easier for the juvenile to get through the system. But that's all I have to testify to. And if you have any questions about the process, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Could you? I think there's going to be questions, but we're going to take the opponents. Did you have one more, Kelly Keegan?
No, Mr. Chair, that's okay. Everyone. We'll just have them wait around until we
there's
have questions.
There's going to be questions. Thank you. We have some people that are opposed that signed up. Mark Anfinson, Janet Ryder, and Tom Arneson. Is there anybody else that's going to testify that's opposed? Okay, then you three have 15 minutes to split between you, if you could all come up. I believe Mark Anfinson is listed first. I think he was the first one signed up. Just go ahead, state your name, and begin. And, oh, you weren't in here, but the three of you have 15 minutes, so you'll have to work that out.
Well, they'll do fine with three or four between the two of them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anfinson. I am the attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the association of all the state's newspapers. We oppose this bill in its present form. We think that at the core of the bill is a concept that is very legitimate, because we don't see this issue of juvenile crime as all or nothing. And as you all know, there are many, many, many layers of juvenile crime, felonies now, that come within the scope of the current law, which is that if you're 16 or 17 and you commit a felony in Minnesota, the records and proceedings of the court, are the juvenile court, are open to the public. That's been the law for about 25 years. My clients get the notion that when a relatively low-grade felony goes on your record as a juvenile, becomes public, and goes into the great web warehouse, that's going to cause you problems, maybe for a very long time. So our view is not that this bill is simply a bad bill. There's a line that can be drawn here somewhere with many of these felonies that would allow a judge to do a balance. Where our concern focuses is on the very serious crimes, the murders, the gang-related crime, the sexual assaults, the aggravated assaults, where innocent victims, and not just the immediate victim, but the entire community where that victim lives, is in fact harmed by these terrible crimes. And if this bill were to pass in its present form, even the perpetrators of those crimes would go into a completely secret process. Would the news media like that? Of course not. What would we sensationalize? Our concern is not the news media. Our concern is being able to convey to these communities that are victimized over and over and over again by juvenile crime that the court system and that the society itself is doing something about it. that there is a response and a reaction by the court system. What would this bill in its present form do to that? It would prevent prosecutors, juvenile court officials, others from telling the community what the government did for them in response to their experience. That's not good policy. Again, you can carve off many of the lower level felonies and allow them to be processed in the old-fashioned, traditional, secretive way. But to do that for the high-profile crimes, we think is a big mistake. One final quick word. The United States Supreme Court has for many decades held very firmly that criminal proceedings in this country, criminal court proceedings, should be open to the public. And the Supreme Court has listed several good reasons why that is the principle that's generally followed in the United States. And I'm not going to recite all those. The one that I think has always been the most persuasive, the best reason, is what the court has referred to as creating an opportunity for community catharsis. Because when a very terrible crime occurs in a community, there's anger, there's frustration, there's a lot of emotion generated, and the opportunity to witness the court system deal with this person who committed that crime allows for a catharsis that's very intangible, but very valuable. So, in its present form, we oppose the bill. We think it's got the potential to be greatly improved. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Janet Ryder and Tom Arneson. Go ahead, just state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Mullery and members of the committee. My name is Tom Arneson. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I'm the managing attorney of our Juvenile Prosecution Division. I'm also a member of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. On behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, I'm testifying in opposition to House File 392. The reason that we oppose House File 392 is that while attempting to address one problem, it turns back the clock and recreates another old problem. As has been mentioned, Minnesota law currently provides that most juvenile proceedings are closed to the public and the records are private. There's a very small exception in the law, which is for 16 and 17 year olds who are charged with felony level offenses. Those are the most serious cases, and it's a very small percentage of the cases that come to us. In the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, last year we got about 7,500 cases, juvenile cases referred to us. We charged 700 felonies. I can't break that down for how many of those are 16 and 17 year olds. That's a very small number of cases. Until 1986, as you've heard, juvenile court proceedings were closed completely, just as they were in most other states in the country. The legislature opened up juvenile court for the oldest and most serious offenses, the felony offenders, in order to shed some light on the functioning of juvenile court. It did this to create accountability. It did it to create the accountability for the youth, for those serious older offenders. But even more importantly, and some of this Mr. Amphinson referenced, it was to create accountability within the system. The secrecy of a closed court created distrust and ignorance of the system. The community had no way of knowing whether its elected judges, prosecutors, corrections department, probation officers, social workers, and other public officials were appropriately performing their duties. Judges, elected officials, public employees, we all operate best when the public is able to see and monitor what we do. I ask you not to underestimate the value of transparency in our government. There are many interested community members in areas impacted by crime who see young people committing crime in their neighborhood, who want to see more access to juvenile court, not less. House File 392 would erode the limited amount of openness that currently exists in juvenile court, and it does so in when there are other ways to get at the issues of whether individuals are being unfairly held back by their delinquency records. A felony charge for a 16 or 17 year old is a public record, whether there's an adjudication or not. Let's talk about what those charges are. those include the most serious of offenses. And let's set aside the certifications and the extended juvenile jurisdiction cases. Those are the homicide cases. Those are the most serious criminal sexual conduct cases, juveniles with serious records. But setting those aside, what's included in this category of cases that we're talking about are the robberies, aggravated assault where somebody's causing serious injury, burglaries of home, home invasions, handgun possession cases, terrorist threats cases, including threats against the schools. These are the cases that the public has a right to know about. We know that teenagers make stupid, youthful decisions. There's a balance. We want to see them turn their lives around, get an education, get a job, and get a career. In Hennepin County, expungement actually is a fairly effective remedy to seal the public record when there's evidence of rehabilitation and the offense is not particularly serious. I can't speak to the experience in other counties, and I've heard that some feel that expungement is ineffective. But let's focus on that as the issue instead of closing down juvenile court. There also is an issue as to the electronic data and the data mining. From what I've been told, the state courts provide their public data to these data miners that are out there. And it goes into the web, to the Ethernet, whether or not a case is subsequently expunged. So that's an issue. So let's focus on that instead of closing down juvenile court or making it more restrictive. If you could completely close up juvenile court and it wouldn't solve the problem. Back in the old day, back before in 1986, employers still got juvenile adjudication records and they'd still know about it now from a whole bunch of different sources. Employers ask kids and young adults, have you been arrested for a crime, for an offense when you were a juvenile? This doesn't get at that at all. It doesn't get at all of the other private databases that are out there that retailers and other agencies privately may collect and distribute. And there's nothing that we can do about that, or nothing that this bill does about that. So you may ask, so what's the big deal? Let's get at something. Let's deal with the most serious cases. Mr. Anfinson talked about slice off the most serious ones. You can do that. But there are still, it doesn't get at the issue of accountability and what's happening in what you may call the run-of-the-mill cases. Those run-of-the-mill cases are still very important to the public and include situations where a community is hit by burglaries, they're hit by a series of auto thefts, even criminal damage to property cases that the public does want to know about. Community groups and residents have expressed concerns about livability crimes, including felony offenses, that the justice system, frankly, hasn't historically treated seriously. Again, these groups want more, not less, access to juvenile court. And the greater concern is how the system operates. Let me give you just a few examples.
Mr. Arneson, I hope that if you're compatriot wants to testify, you've just about run out her time, so however you want to work that.
I defer to Mr. Arneson.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me give you a few examples, and this goes to, can we cut off some level of offenses and focus on, you know, the more serious ones as opposed to the lower level felonies? Recently we had a 17-year-old student who threatened on Facebook to come to the school and shoot up the cafeteria. That's a terroristic threats case. Some might consider that to be a lower level charge. Some might not. Who knows? I'll tell you, in Hennepin County Juvenile Court, it probably would be considered a lower level charge. While that case was pending, the judge released the youth from detention without any supervision on the condition he have no contact with the school. The judge was apparently satisfied that youth was not a danger to the public. How would that judge have decided whether or not the public should know about that? This was not too long before Sandy Hook, and in the post-Sandy Hook world, the public has a right to know how our juvenile courts, prosecutors, schools, police officers are treating these cases. Let me give you another example. Michael Richard Swanson. He was the 16-year-old who killed two people in Iowa. Before he did that, he was charged and adjudicated with a motor vehicle theft when he was 16 years old in Hennepin County. A motor vehicle theft. That's one of those lower-level cases that we don't care if it's public or not. He was adjudicated of that offense. He was placed on probation, and he was sent to the county home school for 90 days. Shortly after having been released from the county home school, he killed those two people in Iowa. With this law, the public would be unable to know what happened in that motor vehicle theft case unless somebody asked the judge before that hearing to open it up, and the judge actually saw it as a motor vehicle theft case and said, this is a serious case that outweighs Mr. Swanson's right to have some confidentiality. These are important types of issues that happen. These are extreme cases, maybe. But these types of issues come up every day and are actually more important in the routine ones that we deal with in the justice system. So you may ask, what's the big deal? The big deal is that the public has a right to know what its government is doing. Don't hope that by thinking that we can make a simple solution to this very complex problem, that we're going to address it, when in fact what's going to end up happening is you're going to decrease the amount of accountability and increase, you're going to decrease the amount of accountability and decrease the amount of transparency in the juvenile justice system.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. And I guess I'll just, since he ran out totally a minute past, I'll just, is it okay if I say Ms. Ryder agrees with his presentation or something?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. The honor. Your honor is behind you. okay, we have a list of questions.
Mr. Chair, I also forgot to mention, just to bring to the committee's attention, that there was also a letter passed out from the probation officers in support of the legislation.
Yes, we have. Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. or Chair Mallory. If Mr. Hayes would come down. Thank you. I know we spoke yesterday, Mr. Hayes, and I appreciate that. And as I recall, when we were talking, you were talking about youth that were with people that made stupid decisions and being charged as part of that group that had committed the crime, but really were there as a witness to it. And then hearing the other side brought up questions, what we talked about yesterday. What do you disagree with regarding Mr. Arnes's testimony, if you would state that for the record, and what do you find is wrong with the expungement process?
Mr. Hazen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Franson. For your first question, Mr. Arneson cited, I think I can safely say that most, if not all, of the cases that he cited could be directly filed for extended jurisdiction juvenile by the prosecutor, especially if the youth is 16 or 17. You can cite the statute for that. I've got a copy of it here, but actually I think I should. So the EJJ process, there's several different ways that a youth can become EJJ, and one is if they were 14 to 17 year old at the time of the alleged offense and a certification hearing was held and then the court decided to designate it EJJ. The second, if the child was 16 or 17 years old at the time of the alleged offense, the child is alleged to have committed an offense for which the sentencing guidelines and applicable statutes presume a commitment to prison, or have committed any felony in which the child allegedly used a firearm, and the prosecutor designated in the delinquency petition that the proceeding is an extended jurisdiction juvenile prosecution. So we there's a built-in system here called EJJ, and the criteria we've built into the legislation that if it's an EJJ case, and in cases where that involve a firearm or are more serious, that would be a presumed commit to prison, the prosecutor just has to ask for those to be open, and then they would be open. The other thing I would add to that is Mr. Arneson didn't speak much about the judge's decision. For those that don't meet this criteria, EJJ, the judge could still open the hearing if they felt that it was a serious enough crime that warranted a public hearing. And your second question, expungement. Yes, well, There's currently a juvenile expungement case at the Minnesota Supreme Court, and we do not know yet what the court's going to do about juvenile expungement, whether that would even apply to juvenile records. The Hennepin County's Attorney's Office, or the County Attorney's Association, I'm sorry, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office appealed a decision where the Court of Appeals said that the court could seal these records. So they're arguing that the kids shouldn't be able to do that at all, you know, in another context. I would also add that, as was already brought up, expungement is later down the road. By the time that's even a possibility, if it's a good remedy, the data collectors have gotten those records. They're out there, as you already heard. Also, Mr. Anderson, he mentioned that employers could already get private juvenile records before. Without breaking the law, employers should not be able to get, or some government entity breaking the law, your general employer should not be able to get juvenile records. Although the Department of Human Services, if somebody's working with vulnerable populations, they will still be able to access these records as they do now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I understand this bill allows judges to decide on a case-by-case basis if a felony-level charge of a 16 or 17-year-old is serious or violent enough to warrant a public hearing and record. I guess what I'm concerned about is, are we giving the judges adequate and clear criteria to be able to have a consistent ruling across the state? So 16 and 17-year-olds committing the same type of crimes would be treated the same across the state.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Myra. There's no specific criteria set forth that the judges would be required to follow. You know, we already entrust judges on a case-by-case basis to make a lot of determinations on whether or not somebody is a threat to public safety, or whether or not the, in this case, that the public's right to know would outweigh the, I guess, juveniles' interest in keeping the record private. So to answer your question, no, there's no specific criteria set forth. But, you know, they do have, I believe, criteria to follow for EJJ cases. Maybe if, yeah, Judge Bastian could come forward and comment on that as well.
Judge Bastian.
Let me just give a disclaimer I should have given when I first came up. I'm here on my own. I'm not representing the Minnesota District Judges Association. I have justice partners throughout the room today on the county attorney side and defense side. I believe we have enough discretion, enough guidance. There are criteria that we have to make findings on when we are going to certify a child. We do probation officers' reports in Ramsey County, so we get a long report, 14, 15 pages. It goes through, I believe it's six different criteria. And then as the hearing goes forth, we have to make findings on each one of those. And at the end, we either will certify or not. And oftentimes, the certification cases that I have been involved with will resolve itself into extended juvenile jurisdiction. And I have some feelings on that topic, but it's not part of this bill.
Representative Barrett, I believe your question was for Judge Bastian, wasn't it?
Chair.
Was your question for Judge Bastian?
Yeah, it actually is. Thank you. And actually, before I ask Judge a question, I just wanted to extend a warm welcome to Janet Ryder, the Chisago County attorney, prosecuting attorney, and I want to thank you for all your hard work in Chisago County. And if you wouldn't mind, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you have anything in particular that relates to our county and as it relates to this issue, I'd be happy to hear that. I think that would be important for me to understand if there. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind. And again, thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barrett. Again, my name is Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney, and I'm the chair of the Minnesota County Attorney's Office, County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. And one of the points that I wanted to elaborate on is the consistency and continuity, exactly what the question that was asked of Judge Bastian, and for us as
as a statewide organization, we know and recognize that the law is handled differently in each of our 87 counties, and our concern is that the way this bill is written, the language that is used with regard to in the discretion of an individual judge whether or not there it's a violent or serious nature of the alleged offense, we know and recognize that that is handled differently and is seen so differently throughout the state that there's virtually no way that we would have any ability to rely upon the types of decisions that are coming out of our 87 counties. Certainly the type of violent and serious nature of an offense in Laverne, Minnesota is going to be looked at much differently than that same offense in Hennepin or Ramsey County in Minneapolis or St. Paul. So those are issues that I can elaborate on. In Chisago County, we have, just like Mr. Arneson represented with regard to the issues in Hennepin County, those same issues occur even in smaller jurisdictions, and we have community members who want to know about what is happening in their community, and they have a right to know about those events that affect their schools. In fact, we had a very similar situation with a threat in our school. So I can just represent that the schools, the public need and have, and from our perspective, have a right to know for the interest of public safety. So for us, it's not just about the unfortunate missteps of these juveniles, which we agree do sometimes happen, but public safety is critical for these cases. Thank you.
Judge Bastian, I think you were really the one that was supposed to have the question.
Well, no, I...
Or didn't you? I thought you had a question for Judge Bastian.
Yeah, I do, Chair Mulvery. Thank you. And I just, but I did want to get a local thoughts about the issue. And so, oddly enough, really strange, because I had no idea what Ms. Ryder would be, what her answer would be. I had no idea, and I didn't know what the question was going to be prior to me. But I actually, the whole thing kind of gels into what I'm concerned about, which happens to be that same section as it relates to the court and having the court decide whether something is of serious nature. And my question really is relates to what your duties are as a judge. I don't know, I'm not a judge, so I'm asking a question. Do you, in fact, as a judge, look at issues based on the law and whether a violation met the criteria for the law? And aren't we asking you to do something that really is secondary to your duties to determine whether a law has been broken? And is there any other thing you're, can you compare this particular section with what we're asking you to do to anything else you currently do in your duties as a judge that isn't related to a particular law?
Go ahead and
Well, I'll try.
Mr. Judge.
I swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Minnesota and the laws. I'm a public official. I'm also concerned about public safety. I have to work with the justice partners. I find in many circumstances there are great disparities in how things are charged. Even in Ramsey County, I believe it's the smallest county in the state, we can have one jurisdiction, police department, charge a kid with a gun with a fifth-degree assault. We have another jurisdiction that can charge a female student with ag assault with a dangerous weapon because she scratched the back of a hand of someone who was teasing her. Second degree assault, fifth degree assault, gun, scissors, both A students, both no criminal record. The gun was pled down to a disorderly conduct. He was not held by the local police department. They brought him to the city hall. Parents were called. They came and got him. The girl was held in the detention center and had to go into court the next day. She eventually pled to a fifth degree assault. So there are already disparities in how things are charged at the very basic level of the police department. Then you get to the county attorney, and I'm not going to fault what they do. They're elected officials. They're appointed. They have to uphold the law just like I do. But there are charging issues that can come up, and we see them all the time. And then it comes to us, and we like to think that we have enough abilities to look at it and say, this is what we do. Now, the law is already very clear in what we have to open and what we don't. And if the county attorney asks us to open a case up, then we have the ability to say yes or no. And we'd look at the reasons. We'd look at things that come up within our terms. So maybe a younger judge may have a different feeling than an older judge, but we have to stand to the public and be reelected. So we're answering just to the same public you are.
OK. Okay, Representative Moran, do you have a quick question that can be answered quick, too?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that was kind of, to your point around disparities, that was really one of my concerns also. I think it's Ms. Rice.
Right.
Yeah. Ryder. Ms. Ryder, who stated that depending on the counties, issues are looked at differently. And that really concerns me because there may be an offense in a rural community which entails someone being caught with a gun and someone in maybe Ramsey or Hennepin County who has a gun, but that case is looked upon differently. I don't know what that means, whether someone is sent to jail and someone is released into the community, but we have those. I think my other question was more around statistics, around how many juveniles go on to become adult criminals, to commit another offense.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know
anyone?
If Mr. Posse knows the answer to that. I know that the testifier from NAMI indicated, I think it was?
65 to 70%
of the I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. I know the testifier from NAMI had mentioned that juveniles are able to be rehabilitated and have a lower, I guess, recidivism rate than adults who are in the criminal conviction arena, if that gets to your question, but I don't know the exact numbers.
One other question.
Representative Moran.
And my hope is that someone could get that that data for me, because I would be interested in knowing that. And, I lost my thought on the third one. I guess, too, when we're looking at juveniles, and I heard a prosecutor mention some stats on, you know, the young, the child who went on to steal a car theft but went on to shoot up. You know, one of the things that we have been talking about in large numbers is talking about mental health, you know, and rehab, and who are getting the services that they need. You know, instead of just locking them up and behind bars or whatever, how we are assessing these young people who are coming into the criminal justice system, and how are we looking at rehab? I mean, there's a lot of things that we could and should be doing besides just locking people up and never giving our young people an opportunity to have a second chance at life.
I'm Anna McLafferty with NAMI Minnesota. Just to rewind a little bit, the statistic that I had said in my testimony earlier, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, was that for children who do have access to treatment in the juvenile justice system, the National Coalition for Juvenile Justice did a meta-analysis of all kinds of different studies out there, the most effective programs, and found that those programs that treat children in the community along with their families can reduce recidivism by 80%. So that doesn't directly answer your question about how many children then go on to the adult criminal justice system, but those that can receive effective treatment in the juvenile system are much less likely to. And I think this bill helps to kind of invest in that treatment by further allowing the child to move on after that treatment is done and after the child has served their probation or whatever it is. And to answer the second question, there are some probation folk in the room that might want to add to this, but I do know, I just spoke with the assistant warden of Red Wing this morning, and he actually commented that there are very few children with serious mental illnesses at Red Wing, because the juvenile justice system in Minnesota has actually gotten pretty good at doing screenings and assessments earlier on and connecting children to appropriate community-based programs plus probation or more local juvenile justice responses. So there has been an increase, I would say, in responsivity to children's mental health needs in the juvenile justice system in this state.
Okay.
We need to go more further, though.
Yeah. We're over time now. Representative Moline renews her motion to pass House File 392 and send it to Judiciary Committee, right?
That's correct.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Okay, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.